The Society for Ambulatory Care Professionals of the American Hospital Association and the Information and Resource Center of National Cassette Services present this audio transcript, recorded in Baltimore, Maryland, at the 1995 SACP-AHA Hospital Home Care Symposium.
I'd like to have the pleasure of introducing to you Senator Dave Durenberger, who's going to share his reflections on the health reform process of 1994 and the implications of that in the future. In 1994, Senator Durenberger retired from a notable career as a U.S. Senator from Minnesota. His thoughtful approach helped him overcome the three difficulties which plague Washington these days: the growing volume and complexity of problems, the historic stalemate on most things of consequence, and declining public confidence in Congress's ability to do their job. After an extended period as chair of the Senate Health Subcommittee, Senator Durenberger continued his driving interest in the expansion of rural health care, reform of Medicare and Medicaid, and child wellness programs. Please join me in welcoming Senator Durenberger.
Thank you, everyone, for the opportunity to be with you today. Begin by thanking Rita especially. She said that this is a tough time to have one of these programs, but it's nothing like my first challenge. I left the Senate on January 4th, and on January 6th, I was in a classroom back at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota, and at St. Thomas, we have the second largest graduate school of business in the country, and believe it or not, I have a class of 19 doctors, nurses, therapists, all kinds of neat people who already have careers in health professions, but they're getting MBAs in business and medical management. And I found out right off the bat that my first class was from 6 to 10 on Friday evening. And I walked into the class and I introduced myself and I said, I know this is a tough time to try to get up here for 4 straight hours. I have to teach from 6 to 10 in the evening. I can't even give a speech on Friday night. I mean, this is my down night. And one of the hands went up, and young Dr. Kathy Brooks, I'll never forget, she said, Senator, you haven't seen anything yet until you get to 1 to 5 on Saturday afternoon, because we've been working all week just like you have. And we work 4 hours Friday night, we work 8 hours on Saturday, and we're all asleep by 1 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. So anyway, there are various tough times to do what you all have to do, but you're kind of the people that are going through tougher things back home or wherever you came from than being here in Baltimore right now. So hopefully what each of us who has the opportunity and the honor to be asked to address you can do is to help carry part of that burden for you, not only today, but hopefully in the future. I really have to thank Thelma Domenici for my being here, because I went to New Mexico for the very first time in my whole life last fall, and I don't know why I waited so long to get there. And met Thelma, and we had a wonderful time, went up on top of a mountain and watched it rain below us and stuff like that. And then she sent me off in a car exploring all kinds of exotic places. And just a wonderful, wonderful woman and a person from whom I've learned a great deal. And when I think about Thelma and her brother, Pete, whom I know even better, and then I listen to you, Rita, go through the leadership list, that's Thelma. And it's probably most of the people in this room, if not all of the people in this room as well. So thank you, Thelma, for the invitation. And I want to thank the Minnesotans, not just those who are here, but all of the people in Minnesota who have given me the opportunity to serve in the United States Senate for 16 years. And then to all health professionals all over this country who have been my education in health policy. I left the United States Senate in January, and I miss nothing about it except the people. And I miss the people a lot. I miss them the whole deal. When I go back there now, I know that I can hear things I didn't hear before. I can see things I've never seen before. And it's a wonderful, wonderful change. And not to miss anything about the power, the position, it's just marvelous. It's really, really marvelous. And so it's a gift to have been there, and it's probably at least good judgment to leave. But when I go back, like this morning, went back for a little breakfast, and met 3 or 4 of my former colleagues, and 3 of the 4 of them at least said, gee, we really miss you. And that I must tell you that when I go back to Minnesota, I try not to tell dialect jokes, but because I'm German and Polish in my background. Everybody else in Minnesota is Norwegian, Swede, Dane, some kind of a Finn or something like that. And so I don't do Sven and Oli very well. But this joke just came along very, very recently, and it's a story about the Norwegian, the Swede, and the Dane who were marooned on a desert island. They've been there 10 years and never saw a soul other than each other. Till a bottle washed up on the shore and a genie popped out when they took the cork off. And the genie says, I am a genie, obviously. what you don't know is I have magnificent powers, but they're limited. In other words, you only get one wish. So he turned to the Dane and said, what's your wish? And the Dane said, for 10 years I've been here with these two guys, and all I've ever thought about is my family back in Copenhagen, and I really, really want to be back home. So off he goes. Then he turns to the Swede, and he says, what's your wish? And the Swede said, you know, I've been here for 10 years looking at these two guys, and all I've ever thought about is my family back in Stockholm. And boom, he's gone. So he turns to the Norwegian, and the Norwegian's kind of standing there like that with his head down, and he said, what's your wish? And the Norwegian said, oh, he says, I miss those two guys so much. I wish they were here. And just like that. There they were. Anyway, I come from a part of Minnesota that you know, those of you who don't live in Minnesota but tune in on public radio know, is Lake Wobegon. It's a little college campus in the middle of the state, way away from practically everywhere, where somebody started a little radio station that, one of my brothers was involved in, the one that wants to go to New Mexico when he retired. Hired a guy from Minneapolis by the name of Garrison Keeler, and Garrison came up there and found out how funny we all were, those of us who lived right there in this little very German community. And then he translated that into Swedish and German and other versions of funny people of whom we were. I didn't think it was very funny, but I'm sure you do. I mean, you laugh about all these things, but that's where I'm from. I grew up before most of you, when home health was Dr. Baumgartner, who came from Albany, 10 miles away, to our house with a black bag, a stethoscope, and an appropriate therapy. And in 1983, I recall this because as chairman of the Health Subcommittee of the Senate Finance Committee, I asked to speak to the American Hospital Association of Washington and to tell them, 1, 2, 3, we're going to get prospective payment system with DRGs and no balance billing. And to the credit of the association, they responded. And over time, people have been, who are in the hospital-related profession, have been responding to the challenge to do things better. But I will never forget that speech. At the time I made that speech in 1983, I'm sure no one had ever heard of the Society for Ambulatory Care Professionals. Now, maybe they had. I should have checked that. But I'm just guessing that you're probably an evolution that's come out of the fact that we said hospitals are not the be-all and the end-all. I mean, there are a lot of other things going on. But the point I wanted to make is that Dr. Baumgartner was my ambulatory care professional. And you are today what Dr. Baum and probably the American Medical Association were just a few short years ago. You're that good. In fact, most of you are better. Now, let me talk in that context about healthcare reform in 1993-94. Health policy reform. I'm not going to talk a lot about healthcare reform because you're all part of that. I wouldn't be here if the system wasn't reforming itself. You wouldn't be here either. Health policy reform, 1993-94, the Health Security Act. The first reason for the failure of healthcare reform was that most politicians that I listened to in Washington, D.C., that you had to listen to also, claimed that we Americans have the best healthcare system in the world. And a lot of them believed it. We have the best healthcare in the world. That's why I can say you're much better than Dr. Baum was a few years ago. We do. It's terrific. But we do not have the best health system, delivery system in the world, nor the best financing system. And the public knows it. Public loves their doctor, or however these words are phrased, but they think the system's broken. So whether it's broken or not, we have a problem in the system itself, but there's no arguing the excellence of the care. We reward highest cost in the system. I just give you an example of why the system's broke. We reward the highest cost on the assumption like in baseball or football or something like that, that the more you pay somebody, the more they must be worth. That's what we do. And the whole system rewards high cost, high charge. So it's pretty hard if you're really good at what you do, but you don't charge as much to get into the ball game. But that's why people think the system's broken. We subsidize supply and demand. We don't subsidize value. Get it? We subsidize supply and demand. We don't subsidize value. And people understand that. They just don't understand it as it applies to their specific decisions, but they know that's what's going on. And all of you know that's what's going on. And so when a politician stands up and says, we got the best system in the world, you got to say, wait a minute. And when he has to go and act on legislation and decide what's good or bad, he doesn't know what to do. The second reason for failure, Michael Kinsley in The New Republic, with whom I don't always agree, said it best. Healthcare reform became a contest over who could promise the least change. Now, I know there are days when you wouldn't like to see a lot of change. I mean, some of you are like up to here with change. Some of you are change agents. Maybe you thrive on change. But a lot of people think sometimes change is happening too fast. Now, if that's what's really going on out there, when the president and the Republicans and everybody else are saying, we can do this without a lot of change, without hurting you, you're not going to have to do anything differently, you get your own choice of docs, your own choice of this, blah, blah, blah. What do you think's going to happen? In other words, the political system is competing to tell people that they can have, you know, whatever it is they like about this system, and they don't have to worry about the other stuff because that's somebody else's change. In that environment, all of the special interests, your association and all the others, is going to say, here's what we agree with on the Clinton plan, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and then here's what we disagree with. And then you spend a lot of money beating the stuff you disagree with. You and 1,000 other professional associations said it. You did it. I know you did. I didn't go back and look at history, but I know you did. Yep, that's the professional contribution to the policy debate. And it's always been like that. But you were encouraged to do it in 93, 94 because the politicians were saying there wasn't going to have to be much change. So you said to yourself, well, then why should we change? You know? We'll salute the stuff that works for us and be against the other stuff. Harry and Louise were probably the best example of that. So why is that particular professional reaction important? Because history tells us that we, the people of the United States, have left the making of health policy to those who produce the health goods and services. We, the people, maybe I'm the only people here and you're all the producers of goods and services. Let's pretend that's the way it is. We, the people, have left to you, the producers of goods and services, the policy, the formulation of policy. Just the way we leave in your hands our care and the satisfaction of our needs, so we have generally left to you the production of goods and services. Now, in normal times, where people like Dr. Baum came to my house, took care of me, and then sent my dad a bill, and if my dad couldn't pay it, he added what he was losing onto somebody else's bill, or he got it back from my dad a year or two later when my dad was in better shape. When the normal relationships that are characteristic of a local market were at work, you know, it would work fine. But we broke that normal relationship up about 40 years ago, maybe 50 years ago. Because we in America said, right after the Second World War, and this is all history and all factual, but I think it helps to understand this so that you know something about how you can impact policy. We in America said, look what we did in the Second World War. I mean, we produced this huge machine, beat all these bad guys, we're changing the world, and let's apply that to our society. What it meant was, we can all have whatever we need. And then, they didn't say it, but without paying for it either. So, we were all guaranteed, the GI Bill made it possible for everybody to go to college. And soon, going to college became almost a right. Employer-paid health insurance with a tax subsidy became a way to make sure everybody bought into a group health plan and didn't cost them anything, except they had to choose which person they worked for. People who are veterans got their homes for free. Most people rented through the Second World War, or they paid half the money down and paid the balance for their home. But after the war, we said, everybody ought to be able to have a home. A home is your castle. You ought to be able to have one. The veterans got it for nothing down and 4% or 3.5% interest, and all of which was deductible. So the rest of us got it for $500 down, you know, forever to pay, and all of it deductible as well. And today, I can borrow $1 million on my home, and it's all deductible. The interest is all deductible, and you pay for it. Today, my kids can't afford to get into college. Today, most Americans can't afford to buy health protection on the margin of their income, which is where they buy it. And how did that happen? Because it's an economic reality, and I'm no economist. I learned this because the guy who teaches the class at the same time I do teaches health economics, and he has a book, and I read the book. Markets are driven by whatever is in short supply. Like, I remember, those of you who are football fans, there's the guy who receives the punts, the kicks, and so forth. I don't even know if they have a name for him. He's become a really important person. A guy by the name of Dave Meggett did that for the New York Jets, and he was terrific, but they traded him to the Boston Patriots. And all of a sudden, the price for these guys went up. And a guy by the name of Mitchell got an extra $1 million from the Redskins because that particular position became more valuable. If you're going to hockey, for those of you who are hockey fans, those of you from Minnesota and Michigan and Canada and places like that, I mean, you may have a really terrific team, but if you don't have a good goalie, you know, the price of goalies in that league goes up, okay? So whatever's in short supply kind of dictates the market. So in this country, what was in short supply when we decided we wanted everybody to have the best possible healthcare system? Our goals were more and better, regardless of the cost. What was in short supply? Doctors, hospitals, nurses, everything, okay? So what did we do? We set out to subsidize supply, and we set out to subsidize demand. We had the GI Bill in education. We had Hill-Burton, which put a hospital in every small town in America. We had capitated access for nurses and doctors and everybody. We got 128 academic medical centers in America. And most of them are in Pennsylvania and New York. That's what we got for it. I read a report that said just the nursing capitation, the American people, paid 8 times as much as we would have paid if we had just written checks to all these nursing students. But some would argue, we did it on purpose to create academic medical centers or nursing institutions. Well, I don't know. Well, whatever we did it. And so we now, you know, we have clearly done it. But I want you to understand, it isn't just in healthcare, not just in your profession. We've done the same thing in education. We've done the same thing in housing. We're all in this together, which is why I get so optimistic about the fact we're all going to work our way out of this as well. But that's what we did. Then we subsidized demand. The tax-free employer-paid health insurance. First dollar coverage by the employer. The employer gets to deduct. You don't pay taxes on it and so forth. What do you think is going to happen? Everybody's going to get health insurance. And each year the union will negotiate for an extra benefit and extra services. And what does that do? It means that everybody who comes up with a unique new way of doing things, they get in the health plan. Now we've got 900 of these different services all mandated at the state level in these health plans. And who gave it to us? The chiropractors, the ambulatory care professionals, or whoever. I mean, you know, we all did it. We all did it. We all did this together in 50 states. We all went and lobbied the legislatures so that our particular service and our particular new way of doing things would end up in all the health insurance plans. Because they were free anyway, so who cared? Who cared? Well, nobody cared until recently. Because by the time we got out of the 60s and into the 70s, it began to hurt. Because we had a high supply of everything, and we had high demand for everything, and you could gradually see we were also getting a high cost. And what did that lead us to? Inflation. I came to the Senate just as inflation was hitting 14.3%. When I came to the Senate, we Americans were living with inflation. We were building it into our paychecks and into our demands like it would never go away. Incredible. Incredible. But we all lived through this together. And it wasn't just health insurance. In fact, the cost of living was going up faster than was the medical CPI in that period of time. Even though now we're getting blamed because we're raising it faster than the inflation, then everything was going through the roof, and we were actually just behind the curve in health care. So is it any wonder when you subsidize demand and supply the way we did, that at some point in time, the cost gets out of reach. So now our goal as Americans is, as it should be, equal access to superior quality care through a system of universal coverage. That's our goal. The only way we're going to get there, we now know we can't get there by raising taxes because the Republicans are the majority party and they will be after 96 and they aren't going to raise taxes, so you can't get there by raising taxes. The last time we raised taxes was 1983 to bail out the Social Security Trust Fund, and we're not going to raise taxes. Praise the Lord, we're not going to raise debt anymore. We Republicans on our watch raised a lot of debt from $900 billion to nearly $5 trillion today, $4.7 trillion. That's a lot on my kids. That's a whole lot on my kids. But we're not going to do that anymore because the public has said very clearly, no more debt. And the third way in which we could do this without doing it the hard way would be mandating that somebody else do it. Like, let's make all the employers pay for it. Or let's take it out of all the paychecks of the people who are the workers and the professionals in the field. And people have said, no, that's just the same as raising taxes and debt. We're not going to let you do that. So there's only one way that in America today we can have equal access to superior quality care through a system of universal coverage, and that is through productivity. By doing what we do better for less money. And there's only one place that's going to get done, and that's in a marketplace. Because government productivity is an oxymoron. I mean, just with all due respect to those of you who may be, like I was, a federal employee, it's an oxymoron. So that's why understanding change and understanding something about markets and things like that is really critically important. Now, is anybody in Washington getting it? I'm not sure they are. The first part of this year, first 100 days, first 94 days, was all about the Contract for America. And what was that all about? Well, my friends trotted out a list of 5,000 different federal programs. And they decided which ones they liked and they didn't like, up to $17 billion. Like somehow that was going to change the way we do business. When the program you select to get the federal government out of depends on where you sit on the committee. Like if your committee chairman is the head of the Appropriations Committee and he's from the state of Oregon, you know, you're not going to lose in Oregon. You're not going to lose whatever it is you've got from the federal government. So I came up here from Washington, D.C. today on Amtrak. Now, most of the people that don't have a train running through their place are against Amtrak. But if you've got a train and good service, you kind of like Amtrak being around. On the East Coast, they don't care because it pays for itself. But when you come back through my part of the country, where there's only one train left to connect us on something other than an airplane, you know, where's my voice in the system? So that's not the best way to make these public policy decisions, by trotting out a whole long list of things we like and we don't like. The second way to do it would be the easy answer way. And there are some politicians that need an answer before they even understand the question. And most of those people, unfortunately, are just very relentless in their pursuit of these misconceptions that they have. One of them, for example, is medical savings accounts. And the people to the right of me on the Republican spectrum, who you'd think would be better economists than I are, all think that the problem is us, the people. That if we only had to pay for these services, everything would change and be different. And so they think medical savings accounts are just the greatest thing in the world. So, but once the guy sold them, the guy that sells them, yeah, Golden Rule Insurance in Indianapolis, Pat Rooney, graduated from the same college I did at St. John's up in Minnesota. In fact, he worked for my dad. He will always be grateful to my father, who happens to be still living, by the way, because my dad gave him a job when he needed a job. Now Pat Rooney is trying to con us all into buying medical savings accounts, and he tells us that at Golden Rule, 1,300 insurance company employees saved some money. And no matter how often you tell them that in Indianapolis they'd be glad to give Pat Rooney's employees a discount in their doctor bills, and they just raise the bills on somebody else, he says, no, that's not true. But politicians are buying this. Republican politicians. The only time I said thank God for Democrats, you know. So, anyway, you get a misconception or you get an idea or something that sort of zings and feels good. And that sort of thing makes sense to Republicans. It must be good stuff. It sort of hangs around forever. It just won't go away. And even the people that know that medical savings accounts don't facilitate change in the system say, well, we have to accommodate to it somehow or other because the Republicans are for it. Third way, I think, not to get to policy change is reaching to the end before, rather than the beginning. And that's a hard one. My friend Bob Bennett, for example, senator from Utah, talks very openly about means testing, Social Security and Medicare and all that sort of thing. Now, that's sort of like the end of the line. After you've changed the system itself so everybody can understand it and can deal with it and can relate it to other things in their lives, then it is appropriate to income relate a lot of these subsidies. But why start there when you could start with stop forcing the elderly and the disabled and the poor in America into a Canadian health system? Why do we do that? Well, the only reason we do it is because we have an American system in every one of our communities onto which you can shift the cost of the Canadian system. So that when the Canadian government called the U.S. Congress, cuts back on Medicare payments, cuts back on Medicaid payments, the cost can be shifted to somebody else. Until the somebody else says stop, then you're in trouble. Why in America today would we continue to run a Canadian system in every community and force the elderly into it and force people with disabilities into it and force low-income people into that system when they could stay in the same system that employed people are in, buying a private health plan which accesses them to a wide variety of health-related services, including all the services that you deliver? Why? Why set up a separate system and shove them into it when they're 65? Well, the answer is because they don't understand that's what it is. They don't understand that they're being put into a government-run system because the doctors and the nurses and the home health people are all private, basically ordinary folks. You don't work for the government, see? So people don't understand this is a government program, and it's basically a Canadian single-payer kind of a system, because we in Washington set the prices for 468 hospital services and about 9,000 Part B services, and you go down there and spend a lot of money lobbying to get a home care infusion therapy into the home as well as into the hospital or vice versa, depending on who you're associated with. You spend all that money trying to influence a Canadian system when you could say, why are we doing this? Why don't we let everybody stay in the American system? Part of the answer is also because the American system's broke. You know, people are not happy with the American system. Why? Why? Variety of reasons. One, because it's a heavily regulated system, out of which many people are bailing out. Remember all these state mandates I talked about? They're still there. All these insurance plans all over America have people who buy those plans have to have in my state hair loss restoration, facial reconstruction, you know, a whole variety of things. A lot of service mandated stuff. It's all still there. They haven't changed that. You put up with that and you're in your business as well, in your profession. So somehow, we are still looking for easy answers. We, the people in political life, and maybe even you who come and listen to former politicians speak. Maybe you're hoping there's a simple answer out there someplace, but there's not. But is there an answer? Yes, the answer lies just basically in logic. It's in logic. And in understanding how we got into this system, maybe we can all figure a way to get out. Now, one of the things that I've tried to do, and I'm just going to leave these with you, and I regret that I don't have something to hand out or something, but because Albert Einstein once said that sometimes you have to believe in order to see. You know, in Washington today, where you don't trust politicians, everybody says, I got to see it to believe it, that sort of thing. Einstein said, sometimes you have to believe in order to see. So sometimes it is important to have some set of principles in which people will believe and people can agree, and then you can flow your change from that. And I'm just going to try some on you, and certainly not get into a debate or an argument, because we got time for Q&As and whatnot if we do. The first one is this, that the doctor-patient or provider-patient, whatever you want to call it, relationship is the fundamental unit of the medical delivery system. That the provider, consumer, the caregiver, the patient, whatever it is, that particular unit is the fundamental unit of the medical delivery system. And it's important to think about that as a principle because a lot of times people think about the hospital as being the important unit, and you're just sort of a part of that. That healthcare is institutionally driven as opposed to personally driven. But if you really believe as a caregiver that you can change and you can do better, then it's an important principle to establish that that relationship is the fundamental unit of the medical delivery system. Here's another one. All healthcare delivery is local. When I say health, I mean health, medicine, subacute, all the names, long-term care, chronic, all the rest of the sort of stuff. It's all local. All local. And even though you may have national standards in your profession, it's still all local. If you believe that it's that relationship that's important, then you should believe the principle that all healthcare is local. Now, why is that important? Because some people say the states can do this. The states can do this. The states are screwing it up now with the regulation of the system. So we don't use state borders to define these relationships. We use community and the personal relationship to do it. So all healthcare delivery is local. We're not going to have a national solution and a national way to do all these things. Third one, medical goods and services are predominantly private, not public goods. Now that's a harder one for people. Because, and I might accept from that some of the public health issues. Oh, the interstate transmission of epidemic and adulterated foods and things like that. But basically I would say these services are private goods and services. I said that last year in a 2,000 gastroenterologists up in New York, and a doctor right away got his hand up and he said, all that talk is nice, Senator, you may believe it, but he said, what I do is a social good or service that can't be priced, it can't be bought and sold, and there's no two ways about it. And I said, doctor, with all due respect, if I can't put some kind of a price on what you do, I can't put a value on it. And if I can't put a value on it, I can't ever get to be a participant in accountability and responsibility and values as we deal with change in our society. But that's a hard one. Fourth, these goods are most effectively and ethically delivered in private markets. I didn't say in private hospitals or private home healthcare settings or anything. I said in private markets. But I also said most effectively and ethically delivered. If I were speaking to a much higher paid group than I am, i.e. some medical subspecialty, some exotica, some place where some doctor does the same thing, you know, to different people six times a day and makes as much as you make in a whole year, if I were in that kind of a group, the first question that went up is, what are you going to do about the last 6 months of life? Now, you'd have an answer to that. But he wants to tell me that if I would just do something about the last 6 months of life, he could continue to operate as he does, making millions of dollars, doing the same thing over and over and over to a variety of people. I believe that these goods and services are most effectively and ethically delivered in private markets, because if we, the people, understood something about the value we were receiving and took the responsibility for the lack of value in our own contribution to the health of the society because of our lifestyle and a variety of things like that, we could begin to come to grips with the issues of values and ethics and all the rest of that sort of thing. Today we can't do that. God bless the people in Oregon for trying, but you're not going to make it. You're not going to make it until we, the people, are all involved in the process, because we are learning to understand the value of our own personal health and how the lack of health contributes to the costs and the burdens on other people, and how responsibility should be rewarded and accountability on the part of providers should be rewarded and all that sort of thing. And that's what you're doing. That's the contribution you're beginning to make to all the rest of us. Only in most part, you're not getting rewarded for it, at least not rewarded appropriately. But injecting accountability and responsibility through the use of markets is very important. Here's a fifth one. You know that your community's markets are working when the medical product or the health product, that is the goods and services, or the process, which is the practice, and the organization, the way in which these products or services are delivered, is constantly changing. I come from Minnesota, and I'm always called the senator from HMO. Senator from HMO, blah, 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 you know all this thing. I don't know what the ultimate delivery system is. And in a functioning market, you know, it is constantly evolving. I don't think we should prescribe integrated service networks. We should prescribe this for this setup and that for that setup. Because in a working, functioning economic system, what you do and how you do it and the organization and the relationships that we have with each other called organization are constantly changing. You all are associated with some hospital systems or something like that, and they are really constantly changing, and they're gobbling each other up, and they're fighting for business and for survival and so forth, and not a one of them knows where they're going to be 5 years from now. And professionally, you're probably suffering a little bit from that. You come to meetings like this, and you hope you're going to get answers. You're part of the answer. You're part of determining where this will be 5 years from now. There's no way that anyone, me included, certainly not me as a former politician, should tell you what that organizational structure should be. We should change the rules so that they reward accountability and responsibility and do a lot of things like that. And then there will be an evolution in this kind of a market. Try some more principles on you. American healthcare system, as I already talked about, is remarkably inventive. Pointed in the right direction, innovation will raise effectiveness and reduce cost. That's saying what I said earlier in a different way. We are very creative. Somebody in this room is inventing a new way to do things absolutely every single day. We are very creative. That's why we're in the care business. And you just point us in the right direction. We can achieve this kind of a productivity that I talked about. Another principle I've already talked about. In the past, the public has been inclined to believe that health legislation, like health services, is best understood by health professionals and therefore has accepted the politics of health espoused by health professionals. Here's another one. The current structure of the U.S. healthcare system perpetuates the belief that there is a medical response to every misfortune. Isn't that the truth? The current structure of the U.S. healthcare system perpetuates the belief that there is a medical response to every misfortune. We instinctively look to the medical care system to solve societal problems, social problems, and to licensure and insurance policy to reinforce it. Now, you know, agree, disagree, whatever. At least that's kind of a, if you understand that and you believe that, then that will lead you in certain directions in public policy. Here's another one that's really important. Where healthier and wealthier citizens do not want to see persons less fortunate than they go without necessary health care and are willing to contribute to their care, then government may act as an agent for this collective desire, taxing the healthy and the wealthy and subsidizing the needy. Now, is there any doubt that here in America, just watch Oklahoma City or anything else that goes on, we respond to the needs of other people? Why? Part of it is a built-in compassion, but another part of it is that we're all better off if we all pitch in. And so, expressed in the terms I've expressed it, we live in a society in which the healthy and the wealthy contribute to solving the needs of the less fortunate because it's good for the healthy and wealthy to do that. But we need a collective agent to help us do that when it's as big as medical and healthcare services, and that's why we use the government. And where the government is off base today is that it is not subsidizing the truly needy. It's subsidizing everybody. Huh? And in fact, it's subsidizing people like me a lot more than people like the really low-income folks that live in this town. They're getting a bigger subsidy. I'm getting a bigger subsidy. So, you know, if you can get somebody to buy the principle, then maybe you can also get them to look at the change. Here's another one. You can't change this system one buy at a time. That's why you see group purchasing. That's why you see CalPERS and in Minnesota this public employee buying. That's why you see employer coalitions and all that sort of thing at work. Because you can't change it one person at a time. A system that needs changing even more than healthcare probably is elementary and secondary education in this country. It's a government-run system that's put in competition with a private system when there ought to be competition and choice within the public system. But one person at a time going to a PTA meeting, you're not going to get it done. So what's happened in our area in healthcare? Folks have ganged up on the providers and said, you got to change. So group purchasing is a reality as an agent for change. As an agent in an efficient system, it's not appropriate because that should be individual people buying and making individual choices. Another one, managed care is managing care, not managing access, managing the doctors, managing the nurses, managing the prices. And because I am the senator from HMO or from the Mayo Clinic or University of Minnesota, I can say that. Because traditionally in multi-specialty settings, in group health and some of these other traditional HMOs, they've actually managed care. And that's managed care. But what you see in so many of the markets represented in this room is folks just managing the bucks, managing the professionals, managing access, and so forth. And that's a critical thing because you want to believe, and I think I heard you say this, Rita, you want to believe in a seamless health system. You want to get out of a welfare-based system. You want to see yourself as part of people's lives, along with the high-cost medical and the subacute and all the rest of this sort of thing. It should just be a seamless, interwoven health system. That's the way you should see yourself. And that's the way managing care will lead you to that. But these other pretenders who are just in there discounting prices and so forth are making this difficult to understand. Here's another one. People who have health needs or medical needs want a satisfying outcome. Why is it then that the financing system judges the delivery system not by outcomes, but by discrete services rendered? Isn't that the way we do it? We don't pay by outcome. And yet, if I'm in need, like I am right now, I mean, my dad and mom got to make a decision to leave Clearwater, Florida, and go back to St. Cloud, Minnesota, because my dad needs 24-hour care. And I think we've made the decision, and we got in contact with somebody in Minnesota who's terrific and laid out all the alternatives, and the choices are being made for us, and it's really marvelous. It's really marvelous to live in a state like that and see this happening. But we're only interested in the outcome. We're only interested in dad. We're not interested in whether he's, you know, he's got this gadget and so many hours of RN plus two and you know, all the rest of this sort of stuff. Why, if that's the way we, the public, look at the system, why doesn't the payment system or the reimbursement system catch up with those realities? And one of the reasons is there's never been an incentive to do the kind of outcome studies that you need in order to reimburse properly or for us to make choices between your provider system and your provider system. So why don't we get on with it then? If everybody here believes in this sort of thing, then let's get at it. Don't wait for the government to do it. Let's get at it. This one may not go over big in this room, but subsidies should be for people, not for institutions. This is a nation in which we, and this is true of education as well as healthcare. We subsidize the hospital, we subsidize the college, we subsidize the academic medical center, when we ought to be subsidizing the people. Now, if you can believe with, oh, then here's one, level playing field, for profit, not for profit. I don't want to even get into that one. Now I will conclude. Future policies, just near term. First, we need national rules, not regulations, for health plans and for the care providers. We need to get some rules for accountable health plans so that these insurance companies, whether they're long-term care insurance or any other kind of insurance, are not playing different games on people and not doing the risk avoidance game. We need antitrust rules. We need medical liability rules. We need ERISA restructuring. I'm a great supporter of ERISA because it enables people to get out of regulated medical systems. But people who come to their health care from the employment setting all ought to be playing by the same rules. Not one set of rules for little people and another set of rules for big people. So that means the folks in Washington need to restructure the rules by which the game is played. Safety and efficacy. We need national rules on safety and efficacy. If we don't like the way the FDA does it, find a better way. And we need national research and education. Research money's running short, education's running short, money's running short big time. Big time. Because in competition and so forth, you're bleeding the cross subsidies. And so we, you as an organization, need to be involved in financing that. But we need national rules. We don't need state regulation. So we ought to deregulate all these local markets by getting the states to get rid of all of their market regulating rules. And secondly, I've already addressed this, understand the purpose of Medicare and Medicaid. The purpose was to make sure that all the elderly and the low-income and disabled people in America had access to what employed people have. Well, we now should know that there's a better way to do that than have the government run the system. But we need to inform people as to what Medicare and Medicaid really is, or we'll never get it changed. We need desperately to change it. In the short term, in the next year and a half, nobody's going to be able to change it. The Democrats have seen an opportunity to attack the Republicans for being insensitive to the elderly, which is always a wonderful thing, and the Republicans haven't quite figured out how to do a voucher-based system or Medicare choice or something like that. And so even though we think we know how to make the transition, I don't think it's going to happen in the next year and a half. But you need to urge us to deal with the future of Medicare and Medicaid. Keep the same name, but please make it a subsidy to an accountable health plan or some other community-based choice. Those plans can help us select both acute and subacute and long-term care. The final thing is where we began this afternoon with leadership. I can't underline more strongly what Rita said to you about leadership. I don't have a list of 14, but I got to tell you, don't wait for your senator and your congressman to lead on this issue. Please, you lead. You have to do it. You have to do it as a professional association. You have to do it as a local community organization. And you have to do it as individuals within whatever community you live. Oklahoma City was, again, an example of what's good about America, even though we always have to see these things illustrated for us in really tough ways. All the publicity, though, is going to be about the talk show hosts and their connection with the two guys from the, or whatever it is, that sort of thing. And we're going to forget about all of the wonderful things we saw and we did as a people. This is a very unique country in which we live. We are now bringing people into this country from other countries at a rate that is about the same as at the turn of the century. It's incredible. The opportunities that we have as people right now for change cry out for leadership, not from Washington, D.C., but from out here in all of these communities. And so you are much more important than you've ever been in that respect. I took these 19 students of mine to Washington, D.C. at the end of a 28-hour course in the first week in April. They came on a Saturday and left Tuesday night. And by the end of 2 weeks later, I had six of those people call me and just say, do you think it would be possible for me to take a year in my life to work with one of those senators or one of those congressmen or something like that? I think that's American. I think that's the way we all are. They saw it as an opportunity, even though these are midlife folks, so to speak. They saw it when they could see it up close, like I gave them the opportunity to do. They could see the opportunity for them to make a contribution. You're working at this full time, and you can make the same kind of contribution in your own communities. You can provide leadership to this effort as well. If I've left any time, I'd be pleased to respond to questions. Thank you all very much for allowing me to be with you.
I'm sure we have, this mic is sensitive. I'm sure we do have some questions for the senator, and we certainly have some time for those questions. So at this point, we'd open it up. Senator, I'll ask you to repeat the question so that everyone can hear.
The question is with a vision of a market-driven system to get productivity in the design and the delivery of services. Where do government programs like the VA programs, Indian Health Service programs come? Some of the DOD programs, which are much more like private sector programs now, Where does all of this come? It's really important, and this is what I learned, I think, by teaching side by side with a health economist. It's really important to remember that markets can give you productivity, but they can't give you equity. They can't get doctors or nurses or even home health professionals to go way up in northeastern Minnesota where there aren't that many people to serve if they don't want to be up there. I mean, if it's not conducive to their particular style of living. And so government has to play a role there. We can go through income related and so forth. We can go through a lot of reasons why we need government to do equity in our system. And that's a really important distinction to begin with. Now, as far as the VA is concerned, the VA has a system which in many communities makes a contribution to medical research, medical education, and so forth. But over time, that system is going to become basically a geriatrics, well, it already is, basically a long-term care system. And if I had anything to do with it, right now I would be making sure that the long-term and chronic care side of this was being moved into community. There are communities in this state where I wish you could, in effect, mainstream all of the veterans. Mine doesn't happen to be like that in the Minneapolis. We have the association with the university and we got one of the greatest heart centers and so forth because there's a professional atmosphere there that holds up that particular, the quality of medical care in that area. But eventually, you don't need a separate a veterans system. As far as the Indian Health Service is concerned, that is arguably a system that either the Indians or the Native Americans are going to run at some point in time rather than the Indian Health Service or the Public Health Service, or it too is going to be mainstream. But just as we think now about how do you do all of this stuff we've been talking about in rural areas you need a lot more equity than you need in big cities because the law of large numbers works against a small town. The same thing is true of most of our Indian communities. Plus, a lot of them have a distinctive health problem. Why we'd run a separate service forever is beyond me, except to keep that cultural sensitivity. But in most of our communities, if I look around here, we are already dealing with cultural diversity with bilingual, trilingual, quadrilingual professionals. I mean, we are recognizing the value that is added by cultural mix in our services as well. So I don't know why we would in the long run continue to run two separate systems. There another question somebody would like to ask? Go ahead. Yeah, the question is about the bundling of I think it was Medicare, wasn't it, which we worked on. That we tried to incorporate this variety of services into each of the 468 DRGs, which would not just contemplate the medical services, but would include this subacute level of services as well. And I did that despite the fact that I want to get rid of HCFA real bad. I mean, I really don't think the government has any business setting prices or determining what services are appropriate or inappropriate or what settings. I mean, I just think those things are so much better done at the community level. But pulling together this variety of services and allowing the hospital-based system or the integrated system to make some money by doing things differently within that bundled set of services is certainly an appropriate. I don't know exactly where it's at now. Maybe they've lost track of the implementation of it. But anyone else have a question about what's going on? I'm probably the only semi-politician on your program. Anyone want to know who's going to be the president in 1996? Yes. Is it possible to reduce the federal deficit or balance the federal budget without reducing what's spent on currently spent on health care? I think the answer to that is it's sort of a yes or no, but let me not sound evasive about it. There are a lot of places in the so-called income security area, Social Security, a lot of retirement programs, the tax subsidy for home interest on your mortgage, the tax subsidy for employer-paid health insurance. There's great big mega billion-dollar opportunities out there to reduce the growth in spending that are not necessarily directly tied to the cost of health care. There is no question in my mind but what you can't balance your own budget unless we do something about the cost in the system. But the other part of that is not just a budgetary issue. It's that we're putting all our money into medicine. It's all into the repair service rather than anticipating these things and dealing with these problems that we all have and the opportunities that we all have in a different way. So it's so important to deal with the cost issue in order to move ourselves to value so that we can look at this mix of services and price and satisfaction and everything else that it is necessary. So, yeah, we definitely need to deal with this issue. The last thing to say, the reason I say yes or no, I'll never forget when I first met Chick Coop when he was a brand new Surgeon General. And we went to lunch, and he asked me afterwards, he said, do you think 10% of the GNP for healthcare is about right, or is too much? This is when it was 10% of the GNP. I said, I don't think any American has the ability today to make that judgment, because none of us are getting the value that we expect to get for 10% of the GNP. If and when we do sense the value for the money being spent as a society, then we'll make that judgment. But we may spend more money. I mean, how do we know? I mean, we may see more opportunity in this whole field in which you are all professionals than is represented by 10% or 11% or 12% or something else. The last thing I will say on percentages that I firmly believe in, as a person who comes from Minnesota but has been around the country a little bit, last year, the CBO said that the current total cost of health and medical and related services is about 14% of the GNP, and if we do nothing in 10 years, it will be 20%. We are doing something, so it'll probably be less than that, maybe 18% or something like that, if nothing is done about it in any place. I know for a fact that if you just took the system as it is now and changed it without making new investments someplace else, we could be within 5 or 10 years, we could easily be at 10% of the GNP or less, just on the existing base, with growth in aging, growth in the predictable growth in aging of the population. We could take the current population or the 5-year, 10-year from now population, and we'd be at 10% of the GNP. That's how much money there is in this system to be saved. Where did I learn that? From you. That's how simple it is. I'm not a genius. I don't read. I do read books, but I don't read a lot of health books because I know the people who have authored them. The real authors are you people. Believe it. I'm not running for anything. I'm not in politics anymore. You are the people from whom I've learned how to do things differently and better. And I think, I believe the capacity in America today for taking that number for a growing number of people with a growing number of problems, taking that number down to 10% or less is very, very real. That's the good news. The bad news is nobody else in Washington believes that. Anyone else? Okay. Have a great time in Baltimore. Thank you very much for inviting me to be with you. Thank you.
This concludes the presentation. For additional information about this or other meetings and conferences sponsored by the Society for Ambulatory Care Professionals of the American Hospital Association, call 312-422-3910 or write to 1 North Franklin, Chicago, Illinois, 60606. For information about additional healthcare marketing related audio transcripts, contact the Information and Resource Center of National Cassette Services, Incorporated at 703-635-4181 or write to Post Office Box 99, Front Royal, Virginia 22630. All rights to this cassette and the information are reserved. Unauthorized duplication is prohibited.